This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to talk about a subject some people consider unspeakable. What happens to a body after death? My guest has a good reason for talking about it. He thinks if people understand this, they'll be more likely to donate their organs after death. Before we hear our interview, which was recorded last spring, I should advise you that some listeners might be disturbed by the descriptions of the body after death. Dr. Kenneth Iserson directs the Arizona Bioethics Program at the University of Arizona, where he's also a professor of surgery. He practices emergency medicine and is the medical director of Southern Arizona's major search and rescue operation. In his book, Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies, he says that approximately 25 different organs and types of tissues can be used for transplant now, and the list is growing. Yet, Americans aren't donating. He wants you to know that your corpse is going to end up looking pretty bad no matter what, so you might as well consider donating your organs when you go.
Death is a mutilating experience no matter what you do. So be generous and help the living.
What are some of the fears people have about donating their organs?
There's a number of fears, Terry, and they're culturally based. One of the great fears is that they're going to become organ and tissue donors before they really had to die. That's actually obviated in our society because the rules are is that a different medical team has to be taking care of you than the team that decides on, for example, death by brain criteria, brain death, or the team that takes your organs. That's a major fear. Others, which are about how the body is going to be treated after death, are that embalming won't be possible or an open casket funeral won't be possible if you donate your organs and tissues.
Is that
not
true?
Not true at all. Not true at all. In fact, modern morticians are specifically trained in how to restore bodies, make them presentable, if nearly every organ and tissue that's possible to take has been taken. And they can still have the open casket funeral. And as we say, only your mortician knows for sure.
Do you find a lot of people are afraid of the pain, even though rationally they know they'd be dead by the time the organs were removed?
That doesn't seem to be a big determinant. It's more the question that, boy, the body's going to be mutilated. They've suffered enough. But in fact, the people that are suffering are the ones that need the organs and tissues to continue a full life or to have a full life. And no matter what you do, being dead is a mutilating experience.
Well, I want to warn our listeners that some people will be absolutely fascinated by these details, and other people will be very uncomfortable hearing them. So, listeners, be advised. I want to talk with you first about the viewing of bodies. You know, when you see a body laid out in a funeral home, it gives you the idea that you can actually be quite attractive in death, nicely dressed and made up, and people can leave the funeral saying, he looked good.
He looked good.
you give a lot of fascinating details about how this illusion of looking good is created. Let's start with how a mortician can get rid of the pain or suffering on a dead person's face.
Well, the whole industry calls it making a beautiful memory picture, which is what you've just described. They actually massage the muscles and the facial structures to allow some of the muscles to relax and to ease some of the contractures that have gone on in the facial muscles. And some of these are just postmortem changes, and some of them may have been looking like the person was in agony. But it's all smoke and mirrors, as they say. It doesn't do anything to help the person, of course. They're dead.
If rigor mortis has set in and the body has stiffened, how does the mortician move the body around? For instance, get the arms crossed across the chest?
Oh, well, sometimes, actually, it's almost impossible to do it if, depending on the state of when they get the body. But indeed, rigor mortis comes on at various times, but at various speeds, and then wears off. So the body eventually does become loose. So again, it depends when the mortician actually gets the body. But they can oftentimes massage the muscles and get them into a certain position. Once they have embalmed the body, however, it often takes on fairly rigid type of position, at least for a while. And so they have to be careful about how they position the body.
Mm-hmm. One thing that really amazed me, some body parts are kept in their positions with the help of super glue or rubber cement.
Super glue has long been used by embalmers to keep eyes closed, to keep mouths closed, to do other kind of things, sealing certain holes in the body. So kind of magic.
If eyes are closed after death, will they open if they're not glued shut?
They can be partially open if they're not glued shut. They're always kept shut one way or another. There's something called an eye cap also that can be used with or without the super glue, and it's put under the eyelids, and it has little ridges on it, and it holds the tissue closed from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's one reason why eyes are donated so frequently, even oftentimes without family's knowledge. In some states, that's permissible, because truly there's no way of anyone else telling other than the mortician whether the eyes have been donated, because you're going to be putting something in to replace any eyes that are taken out. The eyes are going to always be closed.
My guest is Dr. Kenneth Iserzin, head of the bioethics program at the University of Arizona. He's the author of the new book, Death to Dust, What Happens to Dead Bodies. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Kenneth Iserzin, author of the new book, Death to Dust. You are, among other things, an emergency room physician. And as we said before, one of the reasons why you wrote this book is that you'd like people to think more seriously about donating their organs when they die, and to be assured that their body will be mutilated whether they donate their organs or not, because, as you say, death is a mutilating experience. Are you often in the position of trying to talk to family members as somebody is dying or has just died, trying to convince the family to have that person's organs donated? That's such a sensitive subject. And what an awful time to have to talk to a family about that.
You're absolutely right. I've talked to people over my career as an emergency physician, both about donating their loved ones' organs and tissues, and also the question of autopsy when they weren't automatically a medical examiner's case. It's a terrible time to be talking to people, and in this case, people who I've never met before, because as an emergency physician, I've never met this patient. I've never met this family, you know, unlike the general practitioner or the surgeon or others who may have known these folks ahead of time. But there is a limited amount of time that's available in which to donate organs and tissues. And so we have to ask. We have to ask early on. It helps. In many, many states now, they have a checkoff on the back of the driver's license. We often have driver's licenses for these people, and it says, yes, I would like to donate my organs and tissues. And we show that, and we ask the family whether they will go along with this person's wishes.
How do you bring it up to the family?
Well, in fact, in my situation, I have a double trouble role as it is. I first have to tell them that he has died or she has died. After that, with the same team, usually nurses, their own family support group, our chaplain, we've used our morticians who are specially trained in the past, I go ahead and would ask them, prefacing it, I guess, first with the fact that it's an awful time to be asking this, but we don't have any choice because there's a limit on time. If they want to give the gift of organs and tissues from their loved one to help others. In fact, many families are very thankful that they get asked, because they want to do it, but they're not willing to bring up the subject. They may not even have thought about the subject right at that point in time, but they are glad that someone is asking. And in fact, we know from large studies, as well as personal experience, is that afterwards, they feel good about that, especially, I mean, we're a major trauma center, and we see a lot of young people who tragically die. This allows them to know that many people are often helped by the donations of organs and tissues from their loved one.
So I guess a lot of people find some, if not consolation, but find something in the idea that the person who they love so much who has died will, in their death, be at least helping to save someone else's life.
Sure, because if you think about it, we're not saying they're going to help one person, but if they donate both eyes, they're going to help two people see again, mm-hmm. perhaps people hear again with ears, the ear bones that can be transplanted, skin for burn victims. By the way, maybe we should say something just about the skin. I talk to people about skin donations, and they go, ugh, skin, you know. But in fact, the layer of skin that they take is no more than a sunburn that peels off in a sunburn. So it's almost nothing. And it's usually in areas like in the back where they can't see it. But they can take bones, the pancreas, now in some cases the intestines, certainly hearts, lungs, livers, kidneys, you know, on and on. And the list is growing.
If you want to donate your organs when you die, what plans can you make in advance for it? What do you do?
Well, as I said, most states have checkoffs on the back of their driver's licenses. In fact, you can also get a separate organ and tissue donor card from your local organ procurement organization, oftentimes your hospitals. Certainly the university medical centers will have special people, and they'll send you out the cards. You sign them and carry them with you. But the most important thing, absolutely, no matter what else you do, is you have to tell your loved ones that that's what you want. Because the standard of care in this country, virtually everywhere, is that if the physicians, the surgeons, are going to ask the family after you die whether they want to donate your organs and tissues, and if you've told them and explained to them why, your family, then they'll be more willing to do it. But even if you've signed, as they say, you can have a signed organ and tissue donor card in every pocket and one pasted to your forehead when you die. And if your family doesn't agree, you don't get to donate.
Are there things looking back now that you think you were naive about when you started your research for your book?
Oh, probably almost everything in there. The last book that was comprehensive about what happened to dead bodies was written 118 years ago in England. I didn't have a source to get most of this information, and I couldn't find the answers to almost anything. And that's the naivety is what drove me on to write the book, is I just listed all the questions that I had. I said, I'd been dealing with corpses my entire career, and my career started before even medical school because I drove an ambulance for 5 years. So, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. And I said, I don't know all these answers. My colleagues don't know these answers. The lay public doesn't know these answers. You know, the chaplains don't, the lawyers don't. I mean, nobody knows. And the funeral industry doesn't know all these answers either, as has been proved out. So I said, let me start looking into this. And it just kind of developed and developed into the project that turned into the book.
Do you think that the research you did for your book changed your attitude about funerals or about what you want to happen to your body after death?
Yeah, it actually did. I was somewhat ambivalent about what happened to my body. But what I finally came to figure out is that it's really the person that's important, and I wanted kind of simplicity in what would happen to my body after death. So what I put in, and actually I put a little coda in the back of the book because while I was writing, a lot of people were asking me, so I put a little paragraph in the back, said that when I died, just cremate the body and scatter the ashes up on what we call Finger Rock, which is part of our Catalina Mountains. I'm with search and rescue here and spend a lot of time up in those mountains. I thought that would just be kind of nice. But you know what? And of course, that's after every organ and tissue that can be used is donated.
Mm-hmm.
That's afterwards, right? But the whole book has helped me realize even more so, it's fun to be alive. Do everything you can while you're alive to, you know, make it fun.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Kenneth Iserson is the author of Dust to Dust. He directs the Arizona Bioethics Program at the University of Arizona. Our interview was recorded last spring. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air.